It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. How do our cells, genes, and synapses all work in concert to develop and grow into who we are today? UW-Madison scientists are building an atlas of the prenatal brain for people with Down syndrome to learn how an extra copy of a chromosome leads to biological differences in brain development. Your calls, comments, and questions are welcome here at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Our guest, Anita Bhattacharya, is an associate professor of cell and regenerative biology at UW-Madison and an investigator at the Weissman Center. Anita, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, your research is aimed at building this atlas of the prenatal brain with Down syndrome. Could you explain why you're trying to map these brains?
Sure. So we know a lot about people with Down syndrome. We know about their strengths and weaknesses, but we don't have a good picture of how their brains are formed to make them different. And so that is the goal of what we're trying to do, is try and understand what's different about how brains develop, as you said, when they have an extra chromosome that causes Down syndrome. The other reason we wanted to do this is that many of our studies and studies of other people rely on the use of human stem cells. So these are stem cells that we derive from people with Down syndrome, from skin or blood cells, and we convert them to stem cells. And then we can then take those stem cells and turn them into brain cells as a way to understand, again, what is different. And we would like to have some validation that the differences we see with the stem cells actually relate to reality, and so what's really happening in the brain.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says that Down syndrome is the most common chromosomal condition diagnosed in the U.S. And you said there's a lot we do know about the biology of Down syndrome. What is different in the brains of people with Down syndrome, Anita?
So that's what we're trying to find out. You're right. We do know a lot about people with Down syndrome, after they're born. But the brain, all of our brains develop mostly before birth. And so we're trying to figure out what is different.
And how exactly are you trying to create this atlas of the prenatal brain? What does that look like? Is it a roadmap? Is it three-dimensional?
Yeah, that's a good question. We're still trying to figure out how best to make a picture of it. So what we are doing is we are collecting prenatal brain from brain banks, both of control and those tissue that has trisomy 21 or Down syndrome. And then we're doing a couple things. One is we're looking at the differences in gene expression between the unaffected and Down syndrome brains to identify gene expression changes or differences in how the brain develops based on when genes are turned on or off. And then we're also looking at the cells themselves to ask how the neurons might be different, the brain cells might be different.
Anita Bhattacharya joining us from the UW-Madison Weissman Center. We're talking about new research of Down syndrome with our guest, and we invite your questions at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. What are the ramifications of this research? What could we see this used for in the future? What's the possibilities here as your work continues?
Yeah, well, what we hope, the first goal really is to provide foundational information that we and other researchers can build on. But ultimately, I guess what we would like to provide is by knowing the differences in brain development and Down syndrome, it might allow clinicians or families to better understand how the differences in behavior occur and maybe take advantage of the strengths and weaknesses a little more. So for example, if what we find is that parts of the Down syndrome brain are smaller or weaker or don't work as well, then we would try and develop therapies, whether those are behavioral, potentially drug, that's not really what we're thinking about, that maybe avoid that area or strengthen another area. So we think that just having a basic understanding could help with more intelligently designing therapy because, as most people know, people with Down syndrome have a lot of strengths and their IQs can be quite high. And we would like to try and improve their cognitive ability, even just a little bit, so that they can live more independently.
So this isn't about genetically editing out Down syndrome. This is about better understanding the development through Down syndrome.
Yeah, that's correct. We are not doing gene editing. We're not trying to cure Down syndrome or fix the extra chromosome. That's really something that I think is not possible at the moment because the extra chromosome is there from the beginning, from not long after the embryo starts to develop.
Anita Bhattacharya joining us from UW-Madison's Waisman Center. And your research also uses fetal tissue from elective abortions. Why use this tissue? What's important about this tissue that works in the lab?
Yeah, well, it really is the only way to understand prenatal brain development, whether it's in Down syndrome or really any, even just normal human brain development. So, as I said, our brains develop primarily, they form before birth. And so the fetal tissue provides us a window into this brain formation, and that really cannot be replaced with other ways, not animal models, and tissue from adults is not the same. It's already developed. So the dynamic processes are happening prenatally.
So without this fetal tissue, there would be no, it would be impossible to do your research.
Yes, we do take advantage of using human stem cells that, as I mentioned, we derive from people, from skin or blood cells of people with Down syndrome and anybody else. But we don't know if the differences that we see are real or if there's something that just happened because we're growing these cells in a dish. And so we need some validation.
It was a few years ago now, about 5 years, I think, Wisconsin Republicans looked to ban the use of aborted fetal tissue for research or any other purposes for that matter. That I would imagine would have impacted your research. And what do you see as some of the most common myths about the way scientists use this fetal tissue?
Yeah, certainly that would have not enabled this research at all. I think one of the common myths is that as researchers, we go to hospitals or abortion clinics and try and convince women to have abortions so that they can donate the tissue for research. And in fact, that doesn't happen. We obtain our fetal tissue from federally funded tissue banks. There is a separation between the research we do and the abortion itself. So we're not involved in that process. So that's one myth. I think another myth is that we're paying for fetal tissue, which we don't because that is not legal and it is violates the regulations set down at the federal level and also at the university level.
Anita Bhattacharya is an associate professor of cell and regenerative biology at UW-Madison and an investigator at the Waisman Center. And we're taking a look at the development of the human brain and how the research at the UW-Madison is looking at how people with Down syndrome's brains develop and how that research could lead to advances in the future for all of us. If you have questions or comments about this research, we welcome you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and UW-Madison's Waisman Center is currently researching how the genetics of Down syndrome can disrupt development and change the brain before birth. Our guest, Anita Bhattacharya, is an associate professor of cell and regenerative biology at UW-Madison and an investigator at the Waisman Center. We invite you to the conversation as well with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. 642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. And Anita, obtaining federal funding for research projects using fetal tissue was made more difficult under former President Donald Trump. And it was 2021 those restrictions were removed under the Biden administration. The health news website Stat reports that federal funding of studies relying on fetal tissue has yet to fully recover. What are you seeing in your research when it comes to funding this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. We are, you know, obviously we are funded to do this work, and we have not seen really barriers to doing this kind of research, at least going forward in the short term. I think maybe the decrease in funding may come from people or researchers who are hesitant to do the research, because at the federal level, we can still do it. Of course, there are specific guidelines and regulations that need to be followed, but at the moment, the federal government is still funding this kind of research.
To be clear, why would researchers hesitate to do this research?
Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, this using prenatal tissue is ethically controversial. Some people don't agree with the use of this kind of tissue. And so I think some researchers are worried about the climate or the controversy at their institution, or are worried, may not be well informed about the regulations that they need to conform to, which are not unreasonable. The kind of regulations really just include that the tissue is obtained through informed consent.
Do you share any of those worries, Anita?
I feel that what we're doing it the best way we can, and we are following all the regulations and both what we have to do, but also ethical concerns. I mean, I feel very strongly that the work we're doing has value, and that because, as I said, there is no other way to do this, I think it's reasonable to do it, given and doing it the way we are doing it.
Anita Bhattacharya, Associate Professor of Cell and Regenerative Biology at UW-Madison, as well as an investigator at the Waisman Center. What's the timeline of your research look like? Where are you now in this process of creating an atlas of the prenatal brain for Down syndrome? And what's the timeline look like going forward?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, you ask any researcher how things are going, and they'll always say it's much slower than they would hope. And that is true for this project as well. We started this project almost 3 years ago, that we got funding about 2.5 years ago. And it took us some time to assemble the team, the people, the graduate students, the postdocs to carry out the work, and also to make sure that we had all of the prenatal and postnatal tissue that we needed. And so we are just starting now to have data from our atlas, or the first data from our atlas. And so we're hoping to have all the data this year. And then it will probably take us another 6 months to year to put it in a package that we can publish and get out to the rest of the research field. So we're hoping to have a lot to offer in the next year or two.
And Anita, I would imagine creating an atlas of the human brain would be a lot of data to collect. Does artificial intelligence play a role in assessing this data? Have you used AI yet in your work or research, or do you see that coming?
Yeah, so I personally have not, but I'm not the person who does all the data crunching. We have a team of bioinformaticists who work on that, and I know that they do some machine learning, and I know that we consider the use of AI, but we haven't gotten to that point with our data yet. If we do, I think it will be a discussion about how much AI to use, how to use it, whether that's the best way, but we're not quite there yet.
Anita Bhattacharya joining us, Associate Professor of Cell and Regenerative Biology at UW-Madison, as well as an investigator at the Waisman Center, looking at the research ongoing right now into creating an atlas of the prenatal brain of people with Down syndrome. And we welcome your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. So, Anita, if I were to walk into the lab on a given busy day there, could you give me an idea of what the work looks like on a day-to-day basis, or where you're at right now, and what the untrained eye would see going on?
Yeah, so in most of our labs, because this is a group of four researchers working on this, in most of our labs, you would see a lot of students and postdocs who are working in on cell culture, so on the stem cells themselves. Because as I said, what we're trying to use this Human Atlas for is to compare it to, or sorry, to validate our stem cell data with the tissue, prenatal tissue data. And so most of the people who work in the lab are actually working on the stem cells. We have one lab or one set of people who are working on the prenatal tissue. And so it's a lot of students, postdocs, young people, undergraduates, who are, again, have working with cells in a dish, sometimes these three-dimensional cells that look like little balls of cells. And then we also have people who are doing the analysis of those. So taking those cells and isolating the DNA or RNA and looking at that. And then we have a team of bioinformaticists who are taking the data that we get and crunching it on their computers. And I don't know really how they're doing. That's why we have a team,
right?
Because everyone has their own expertise, and that's not mine.
Well, in total, then, how many people are working at this on this research at the Waisman Center, Anita?
Yeah, so we have four labs that are working on it, and I would say it's probably close to 15, 20 people are working on it in some form of another, either working on the prenatal tissue atlas or working on the stem cell that we want to validate, or working on projects that have already begun to become offshoots of the project. So if we have a little data already, that leads to one story, one hypothesis. So we also have some offshoots of the main data that we're working on.
Yeah, very interesting. I'd imagine, as in any research, you start coming up with more questions the more you look for answers. Are there more questions that you have found? Are there offshoots of this research that you intend to investigate, Anita?
Yes, we anticipate that once we have really analyzed our data, as I said, in the coming year, that we'll have enough new questions for all of us for the rest of our careers. and for you know, other people in the field. You know, we're not the only ones working on this. And actually, the field of Down syndrome research is fairly small. And so one thing that I really hope is that by providing this data, other people, other researchers who may not have been working on Down syndrome might find their niche or their story or their hypotheses that they want to test.
So your research into Down syndrome, at least in your hope, would lead to further research in Down syndrome and broadening the field a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. And I think one area that is getting a lot of attention now in Down syndrome research is the fact that people with Down syndrome are at a very high risk for developing Alzheimer's disease, and they will do so in middle age as opposed to in the general population. And so I think it's possible that some of our data or our work might indicate that there are processes that are happening even as early as prenatally that might inform us to the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Because it happens so much earlier in individuals with Down syndrome.
Wow. So this may lead to your research into Down syndrome and the development of prenatal brains could lead into the possibility of other further research into the root causes of Alzheimer's in this country?
I think it's possible. We'll have to see what the data
says. that's the way research works. You go where the science leads you and what the data says. And Anita Bhattacharya, I want to thank you for sharing what's happening in your lab with us this morning. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Anita Bhattacharya is an associate professor of cell and regenerative biology at UW-Madison, as well as an investigator at the Waisman Center, where they are currently researching the development of prenatal brains for people with Down syndrome and creating an atlas of that brain with data expected later this year and the research ongoing in our backyard. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer-Kent, and conversations like these are never easy, but they're also impossible to avoid. How do you downsize from a family home filled to the brim with fond memories and move into a smaller space that's just, well, empty, but hopefully more manageable? It's not easy, but there is help, and we invite your questions and comments throughout this conversation about downsizing, 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Perhaps you've had the talk. Perhaps you've had the experience. You can also email us anytime, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Jean Long Mantefell, owns a professional moving service in the Fox Cities. She's a third-generation mover and created Long Senior Transitions as an extension of the business to support seniors in all aspects of moving. And Jean, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Lee. It's great to be here.
Your grandparents started what would become your current moving business, and you've decided to carry on your family's legacy quite literally. Why?
I love helping people. And believe it or not, in the moving business, every day we get to help people through a tough time in their life. It's one of the most stressful things you can do is move.
Absolutely. But you're not the end of the line here. As I understand, there's now a fourth generation mover in your family.
Yes, my son Mike worked with me, and it's a joy to have him there.
So how much of your family is part of your business? How many family members you got going there? Everybody?
Well, we're down to Mike and I.
Okay.
just the two of us.
And how did you transition from just moving to specializing in helping moving seniors transition from family homes into more manageable spaces?
Well, when people would call the office and be looking for a mover and have questions, quite often we would get calls from someone that was absolutely in tears, overwhelmed with the process. And it was generally a senior leaving their house that they had been in for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years. So my office always knew that was my customer. I got dibs. I wanted to go out and help that person. And then I think it was 15 years ago, I saw an article in Good Housekeeping that they do this nationwide, help people through the transition. So I called the lady in the article. She was in Atlanta, Georgia, and she said, "Darling, they do this everywhere. You just need to learn about it." So I learned about it, and I came back from the training, and I was like, it's like my calling. I love helping people through this tough time, and it is a tough time if you're not ready.
Yeah. So I where do you even start? That's why I'm hung up on the question. The first question is, where do you even begin? And then what do you tell somebody who looks around at a home that is just their entire life, their entire family and memories in every nook and cranny? And how do you even begin to walk away from that, Jean?
Oh, it's not a matter of dealing with all the things in the house. If I could have my druthers for any customer, I would say, pick where you're going, then take there what you want, and then deal with the contents of the house. But people are always trying to deal with the contents of the house first. But if you're moving to a senior community, there's a living room, a bedroom, maybe two. Maybe the second bedroom is an office and a kitchen and a bathroom. So outfit those rooms with your treasures and things that are practical for that house, and stop trying to deal with the volume that's left behind. Leave that for a professional, because that's the part that people are overwhelmed with.
Not the old space, but the new space, or not the new space, but the old space is what causes the anxiety here.
Oh, absolutely, because
Okay.
they're trying to get rid of the things in the basement, and they haven't been out in the basement for 5 years, 8 years. They're trying to deal with sheer volume, and none of it's moving anyway. It's the things in the basement are not going to your new home. So let's pick your beautiful treasures that belong in your new home and make your new home perfect. And then let the family, let the kids, let me, let professionals deal with the remaining contents.
Let the chips fall where they may. We're talking about life transitions in senior adulthood with Jean Long Mantefel, our guest, who is the founder of Long Senior Transitions in the Fox Cities, as well as the columnist for Ask Jean in the Appleton Post-Crescent, which appears monthly. And we invite you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, dealing with seniors downsizing from their family homes may be one thing, but Jean, what about the children of seniors who are looking to downsize? Do they become part of this equation as well? And how do you deal with them?
So they do become part of the equation. First of all, I hear so often parents say, well, we're just going to leave it all for our kids to deal with when we're gone, like it's a gift. It's not. So then the kids come back with, well, that's okay, mom. We're just going to get a dumpster. And I think I hear that every week.
Wow.
Every mom, we're just going to get a dumpster. The most hurtful feelings, the most hurtful words that you can say to a senior, because everything in their house has a reason, and has a memory attached to it. So, kids, don't say that to your parents. When they ask you to help with clearing out the house, help. When they say the time has come for us to move, don't say, Mom, you can't sell our house. Say, Mom, how can we help? What can we do? And kids, go get your stuff. You have stuff at your parents' house still. Go get it and unburden your mother from your childhood bedroom that's still sitting there in all its glory with your trophies. And it's
Go pick them
maybe
up. They're
go
yours.
get them. Yeah.
Gene, what about a parent who is struggling to manage the space that they have and yet unwilling to walk away from so many memories and so much of their belongings?
So it all is a tough time. And so if your goal is to stay in your house, then perhaps you need a process to put in place to make your walk spaces safe, to keep you safe in your home, put up grab bars, do the things that make your home a safe place. Unfortunately, I see many seniors that say, I'm staying in this house. And I even hear the, they can drag me out of here, with my fingers dragging on the door frame. That's the only way I'm going out. It's like, well, good to have a plan. And how cruel to your children to make them swear you'll never make me leave this house.
What
They're
does a
not going to.
child say to that, though? I mean, that sounds pretty obstinate, and who am I to say otherwise, in bringing it up?
Yes, who are you to say otherwise? But let's have the conversation and let's be open. Let's both sides be open. Mom, we would not have you leave the house if we could help it. But if the time comes when you do need more care than we, the children, can give, be fair, be open. Let's talk about it now, that don't ever make me make a promise that will torture me later if I can't keep it. Because sometimes you can't keep it.
These are just such tough conversations, and I struggle to imagine, whether or not I'd be able to stand up to them. What do you get out of this work that you've been doing for so long now, Jean, and work that you were doing before you even knew you were doing it? at the end of the day and the move is done and you've got a senior transitioning into a more manageable space, what's it for you?
Actually, it's every week it's a joy because I get the letters afterwards, and pretty much every one of them says, we should have done this years ago. Because seniors, when they get to the new place and they have just the things they need and they love their, they still take to their new place, the surroundings that bring them joy, their special treasures, not all their treasures, but their special treasures. Their new home looks like a home and feels like their home. And, but they have less work. They're not exhausted. I had one gal, I told her, I said, I think after you make the transition, you'll have 25 hours more a week to do what you want. And afterwards, she was like, I do. I'm playing cards. I don't even want to go back to the old house and clean it out. I want to have fun with my new friends. It's fun. It is really fun getting people from point A to point B, but boy, that process is tough.
Gene Long-Mantefel, our guest, the founder of Long Senior Transitions in the Fox Cities and the author of the Ask Gene monthly column in the Appleton Post-Crescent. And we invite you to our conversation about downsizing for seniors now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Elaine and Ford Atkinson, good morning.
Hi there.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
Good morning. So when I sold my house half a dozen years after my husband passed, my daughters, I have three daughters, and they came over, and I said, okay, you know, you go through, decide what you want. Two of them said half of the stuff. What did you save this for? One of them said, is that all? So, I don't know. I was in a good place, you know, to, you know, just say goodbye. You know,
yeah.
I don't need this, and I don't. I'm not taking anything that I don't want to have in my house. So anyway, that. But I just thought that was so cute. Two of them, you know.
Was it hard, or was it the kids that was the tough part?
I thought the hard part was going to be for the kids. And of course they're all adults and homes of their own. And, but, no, I was ready, you know, and I knew it was a big two-story house, and I knew either I sell this now or in another 10, 20 years, my daughters are going to be saying, how do we get mom out of here?
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, what a gift you gave them. What a gift.
Yes, thank you.
Well, thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much for a cute story, Elaine. I very much appreciate the call and the perspective. And Gene, this is a family and friends affair, right? Nobody does this alone.
Well, this can be a family and friends here, and nobody should do this alone. How's that?
Explain.
Because sometimes I had one customer, she said, when I told my son we were selling the house, he was furious and he wouldn't speak to me for 6 months. What do you mean you're selling our house? And so kids need to like wake up, be, you know, quit being a baby. The fact that he lived in Texas isn't her problem. I used to tell the kids, if they don't want you to sell the house, they have first right to buy it. But it can be a tough time. So help your parents. Sometimes you that gal just mentioned how the three daughters. All kids should be on the same wavelength. You should, as a team, be approaching it, because you don't need one saboteur that says, why are they making mom move? Mom, you should stay in the house. Making that decision is a tough decision. So be supportive. Support in every way you can. Ask what you can do to help. And if your mom has 600 bells and asks if you want any, take some. And then ask for more, because she wants them to go to someone that'll treasure them like she does. So help.
It is about help here with our guest, Jean Long-Mantefel, who is a certified relocation and transition specialist with the National Association of Senior Move Managers. She also writes the monthly advice column for Transitions with Jean for the Appleton Post-Crescent. And she says, just be there to help. 800-642-1234. Have you had the experience of downsizing into a more manageable space, of having to leave some places where your memories reside behind? And how did you take those memories with you? We'd appreciate your stories here. 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're talking about what to do when the time comes for seniors to make that move from their beloved family home into a space that can better suit their needs as they age. Just how do you do that without feeling like you're leaving so much behind, so much of what you'd want to keep forever? For answers to that, our guest, Jean Long-Mantefel, who owns a professional moving service in the Fox Cities, is a third-generation mover herself. Her son's the fourth generation. She also created Long Senior Transitions just for this purpose. And we invite you to our conversation at 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We go to Michelle next in Darien. Michelle, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, what's your story?
So we recently, back in fall, my mom and my brother live together out in Wales, Wisconsin, and my brother is slow and she had dementia. We've known that she had early onset dementia for a while, and it came to the point where she didn't recognize who he was and he didn't know what to do, so we had to, after a few incidences, pretty much remove her from the home and get her into a memory care unit. And the only place that we could afford was a small room, but it was her own private room, but it was a nice facility. Trying to figure out what we can put in that room and what we can keep to make her feel like she's important and she can still have some of the stuff that she had from a house that she lived in for 40 years.
Yeah. Michelle, I want to thank you for sharing that story of your family, and I hope it goes to helping other families as they listen here. Because, Jean, you're the person to help answer this question best, and I'm sure you've come across this before. What do you fill that room with for Michelle's mom?
So Michelle, I bet you did great. It's still what are her needs at that time, and what makes that room feel like home. So in the beginning, Lee, you said something about that it feels empty. Mm-hmm. Most of my senior apartments don't feel empty. They're over full. So it's, what does she need? First of all, she needs a chair. She needs her TV, a dresser, a bed. And then she needs, so those are the logical things. But then she also needs whatever next to that chair is what she normally has next to that chair, like an end table somewhere she can put a remote so that it feels so it feels like it normally felt. Maybe the Afghan on the back of the chair so that it feels like it customary. You want the TV across from her where it always was so that it feels normal, so that things feel, especially with memory care, you want her to still be her bed, to have the same bedspread on it. This isn't the time for kids to feel like, oh, mom, don't take that junky old bedspread. We'll buy you a new one. Take what makes it feel familiar and makes it feel like home. Put the pictures up that she loves and treasures, and make that room feel like home. And I'll bet Michelle did, because I can tell by Michelle's voice mm-hmm. that she went into that task with a caring attitude. And how can we make mom's room feel like home?
When it comes to mementos, especially for a memory care center, are those impactful around the room?
I'll start that with my dad had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So we thought that they would be impactful, but they may be less impactful than you realize, because if the memory is slipping, they don't. But some things really did have a lot of meaning to him, some treasures. So, but But when you're moving someone into a memory care, you want to get that room ready before they go, and you don't want them to participate in all the decisions. You want to just pick it, go set it up, and make it so that they walk in the door, they feel like they're at home. And yes, having mementos that bring comfort, but to me, it's a sensory thing also. Like I mentioned, the Afghan, the bedspread, the things that make that feel like home.
Jean Long Mantivel owns a professional moving service in the Fox Cities and created Long Senior Transitions. And we continue with your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jody in Mount Horeb, good morning.
Good morning. I appreciate this program so much. Thank you for having it on, and thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
So my story is my dad was an agriculture teacher for 40 years, and he saved every paper from teaching. Seriously, he did. So sure. When we were going to move them from their farmhouse, and he had a kind of a big barn kind of thing, and he saved all of his papers. So as we were packing up the house, I went out and my dad was looking at every single paper. It made me want to cry. And he was so sad, you know, and he was trying to decide which ones to keep. And I go, Daddy, you're not teaching anymore. So maybe we can get rid of these. Well, he just couldn't handle it. So somebody, we have six kids. One of the kids took him for a fun afternoon. My brother went and got a dumpster, loaded up everything from that barn and took it to the dump. And you know, my dad never missed it.
Whew, that's a relief.
Yeah.
I imagine this was difficult for you, Jody, as hard as it was for your dad, it had to be, you had to feel it too.
Yeah, all of us did, because I was like, I'm a teacher. I get it. You know,
sure.
I've saved papers that I don't need anymore because they have memory. But yeah, for moving on, they had no room. They were moving to a log cabin they built, and you know, they didn't have room for any of that stuff.
Well, I'm glad your family made the decision and moved forward with your father. Thank you for the call, Jody. And Jean, we only have about a minute left, but considering Jody's call this morning and Michelle's and Elaney's, when it comes time to make that move, what's the best first move to make?
If I could have my choice, figure out where you're going to go and go. Take the items, furnish the apartment, and go, and then deal with the house, because like a barn full of papers is not something you want to go through paper by paper by paper. Get out of the mayhem. Get out of, just go.
Jean, thank you so much for having this tough conversation with us this morning.
Thanks,
I very
Lee.
Much appreciate it. Jean Long Mantivel is a certified relocation and transition specialist with the National Association of Senior Move Managers. She also writes the monthly advice column Transitions with Jean for the Appleton Post-Crescent. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and let's meet the detectorists. The first patent for a portable metal detector was handed out 99 years ago, but in the last handful of years, we've seen an increase in the sale of metal detectors, as well as dozens of clubs across the Midwest that have turned the hobby of metal detecting into a growing community of detectorists. What are they looking for, and what do they find? 800-642-1234 to join our conversation this hour. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org anytime. Our guest this morning, Rob Rizzo, is the history digger. He travels the state with his metal detector, finding homeowners who want their old property searched for historical objects or lost items. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Lee, thank you so much. It is a pleasure to join you in the audience today and talk about metal detecting.
I'm very excited about this. Also joining us, Jim Winter, known as the Driftless Digger, and has been metal detecting as a hobby since 2019. He gives educational talks on the subject across the state. Jim, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm glad to share the stage with Rob.
You bet. And let me start with you, Jim. What got you down the path of metal detecting? What got you started and what kept you going?
Sure. So when I was a kid, I begged and begged and begged my parents for a metal detector. And finally, at the age of 16, they got me one, a cheap kid's metal detector. And I used it for about a year. Found some stuff in my yard. I was really excited by it. But then life got in the way. High school continued, girls, college. So I didn't really metal detect anymore, but I kept that child's metal detector. And throughout my moves, I kept it with me. And then in 2019, I was cleaning out my garage and saw that metal detector sitting there. And the wires connecting the battery to the detector were frayed. And so I couldn't use it anymore. And I kind of had an epiphany moment. I was like, you know what? That 1 year I used it as a kid, I really liked doing it. Why not do it again? So I went out in 2019 and purchased my first professional grade metal detector and have been doing it ever since.
And I can get the sense of the contagion there as a kid getting a metal detector and going out into your own yard and finding things that were just beneath your feet that you never knew were there would be like opening up an entire world that was, you know, just hiding right underneath the dirt.
Yep.
Rob, what got you started down the path of digging?
Well, you know, when I was a small child, my grandmother, Grandma Rizzo, owned and operated an antique store. And surprisingly, she let her grandchildren like roam free among all these different mysterious artifacts and treasures. And that kind of sparked my interest, I will say, in history. Mm-hmm. Okay. And at the same time, I also realized I liked science fiction and time travel. And for me, you know, I share some of the same things that Jim enjoys, but this kind of combines two of my passions, because metal detecting helps us connect to, you know, things in the past that we can bring back to the present and share and preserve, tell the stories about these historical items for future generations. So it was, you know, a few years before I retired, my children had heard me talk about this passion for so long that they purchased for me my first metal detector. And let me tell you, once you find that first cool, interesting item, you are hooked. So I've been enjoying it ever since.
What was that first cool item for you, Rob?
Well, surprisingly, I was on a beach in Waukesha County in Oconomowoc, you know, very public beach. I am pretty confident it had been metal detected many, many times before. But very close to an old lifeguard chair, I found a silver Mercury dime and a beautiful coin, U.S. coin. And the fact that I actually could find something of age, I was like, what else is out there? Let me loose and have at it.
There's a lot of grains of sand out there that need to be dug through to find out what's underneath. Jim, was there an item that you discovered early on that was like, I want to know what else is under there?
Yes, there was. One of my first properties I detected was a friend's one-room schoolhouse that he had converted into a house just outside of Platteville, Wisconsin. And I took my detector there. And one of the first things I found was a church key can opener. And so one end is a can opener, more for metal cans, not for beer cans and such. But then the other end had a couple holes on it, like a key would. And one of those holes fit the screws of headlights of early Model Ts and other early cars that you could, it was a tool you could use to loosen the headlamps on them. So when I found that and did the research, and to me, research is just as much fun as finding the item, and knew what that was, I was hooked and was like, there's a whole world of possibilities, like you mentioned, Lee, out there. You never know what you're going to find coming out of the ground. And so that's the fascination, the curiosity for me.
But as you mentioned, Jim, when you pulled it out of the ground, it's not like you immediately knew what this was. You had to go on the path to figure out what you'd uncovered.
Right.
How common is that?
Pretty common. A lot of metal detectorists, I know Rob does too, we research our finds because we want to tell the story of what that find is and maybe the context of where we found it and what it means and when it was used and educate people. And I'm a history nerd like Rob as well. And so educating myself about something can only help me going forward as I continue metal detecting, that next time I find it, or somebody asks, what is this? I can tell them. So it's important to do the research in the background.
So not just detectorists, but historians, storytellers, and giving us a tie back to our past that was lying just beneath our feet all along. We're talking about metal detecting with two veteran Wisconsin-based detectorists, Jim Winter, known as the Driftless Digger, and Rob Rizzo, the History Digger. And I bet you've got a story or two to tell about detectoring, where you are and what the metal detector dug up in your experience at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, where we go to Elizabeth in Verona. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning. My father-in-law owns some land up in Washburn, Wisconsin. He, this land used to be a field and have some homes on it. We metal detect together when we're up there. Mm. We were able to find a metal Social Security card. When we pulled it out of the ground and wiped the mud off, it was still completely legible. You could see the name and the Social Security card number, the decorative piece where it looked just like a Social Security card, but metal. We did our research, and it turns out it was the old landowner who probably it fell out of his pocket or his wallet while he was working the land or at his home.
Do you know about what year this card would have been issued? I didn't even know they made metal Social Security cards.
No, we looked it up. They didn't officially make it. It looks like you could have purchased it yourself if you worked in a hard labor and you were afraid that your Social Security card would get ruined in your wallet or something. But I believe it was the early 1900s. And I wish I could remember more, but unfortunately I can't.
Oh, that's a great story, though, Elizabeth, and I thank you for sharing it. Let me see here. Rob, have you ever come across a metal Social Security card before?
No, that one is still on my bucket list, but it's a great example of, I mean, there's so many unique items. I mean, you probably can imagine. Yes, we find a lot of coins and the things that people might have carried in their pockets, that kind of thing. But, you know, Jim touched upon something, and you did too, Lee, you used the word community. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so nice because when you do find something, you know, we have several groups we can post these items to and basically say, hey, what is this? You know, can anybody help me? But the research doesn't just occur after the find. Part of the fun is also researching the property prior to even going there. There's certain things available in public libraries, plot maps. There's a website called historicalaerials.com that contains aerial photos. You know, some cases back to the 1930s, if you could believe that, that show what buildings at that time were on the land. And if something was there in 1930, it might have been built before the turn of the century. So there's a lot of things, you know, before and after the actual event of swinging a metal detector over the ground that, you know, help us enjoy this community and help us enjoy the research and help us eventually package all of this into wonderful, exciting, informative stories.
Yeah, it's just the metal detecting that we all get to see and wonder what it is that they're finding there. And then once you start expanding on that, you realize that they're finding our history, our shared history, and in some cases, some very personal history as well. It's Rob Rizzo, the History Digger, traveling the state with his metal detector, finding homeowners who want their old properties searched for historical objects or lost items. Also joining us, Jim Winter, the Driftless Digger, who's been metal detecting as a hobby since 2019. And your questions and comments and stories about metal detecting when we continue at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Listening to The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and we're digging in the dirt with two Wisconsin detectorists, and we're learning more about the hobby of metal detecting and the community it creates with our guests, the History Digger Rob Rizzo and the Driftless Digger Jim Winter, both veteran detectorists in Wisconsin. We invite you to our conversation with your questions or stories. 800-642-1234. What did you find when you started digging? 800-642-1234. And Jim Winter, for people who have never picked up a metal detector before, what's your best advice for getting started?
A lot of metal detectorists, when they start, they want to go, they'll go to Radio Shack or Walmart or Bass Pro Shops and pick up a really cheap $100, $150 metal detector. And I recommend people do not do that. Because those really cheap metal detectors will only make one sound no matter what metal you go over. They won't tell you how deep it is. They won't give you any indication or information as to what you're finding. And when people who are beginning use those metal detectors, they get frustrated real fast because they find a lot of bottle caps and pull tabs and nails. So I always recommend investing a little bit more money. You can buy a really good metal detector for $200-$300 that will differentiate tones based on what metal you're finding and will tell you depth, and you'll have a little more success in what you're finding and a little less frustration. But even the people who've been doing it for a long time, like Rob and I, we still find a lot of trash when we go out metal detecting. It's not always finding all the treasure. You have to find the trash to find the treasure. But that's the one thing I'd recommend is invest a little bit more in that first metal detector, and you're not going to get frustrated as easily.
Let's go back to the phones now at 800-642-1234. Zeke and Bowler, good morning.
Good morning. A quick story about some friends who told me that grandmother had thrown her wedding ring out in the dish with the dishwater out the back door.
Oh, dear.
I went there three times, and then the third time I finally found it. She must have had one heck of a good arm because that ring was 35 feet from the back door. And
oh, wow.
It was in 3.5 inches of soil, so there must have been some landscaping done there, because I kept checking closer to the door, and I cleaned it out. I couldn't find anything else.
Are you
do you do
metal detecting regularly? Yes. Zeke,
I've been doing it for probably 30 years. But I encourage anybody who detects to please carefully fill their holes in so it looks like nothing was ever done, because that is one thing that discourages people from doing it. Not people, but communities that allow you to do it, because they come across these holes, it looks like a skunk has been there digging up the whole yard.
I had not even considered that, Zeke, and I thank you for the call. And, it is about, I guess, the best practices of being a digger and a detectorist. Rob Rizzo, the history digger, how do you go about making sure that you are protecting the spaces that you are searching?
Well, there's two things that kind of tie together. In addition to what Jim said as far as a recommendation, the other thing we often, encourage people to do is join a club or metal detect with somebody else who's been doing it for a while, because they will, they'll not only teach you the ropes about the machine, but also help educate you about what we refer to as metal detecting etiquette. There's some very clear do's and don'ts with regard to, we never trespass. We should always, as Zeke said, fill our holes. It's really important to get permission on the property, to be respectful if anybody comes up, to ask you what you're doing. So, there's a good understanding in the community that we want to keep this hobby and preserve it for future generations as well. And as the hobby grows, it's just important to do that, to be respectful. But he absolutely brings up a great point.
Jim, what would be the proper etiquette when you would go to a person's home, private property, and bring your metal detector?
Oh, well, I'm blessed enough that I don't usually have to door knock to try a cold call, as you would, to try and seek permissions. I have people come to me asking me to come out to their property. But on the rare occasions I do have to go and door knock, or I want to door knock, I simply knock on the door and wait for them to answer. And I explain who I am and what I do, that I save history through metal detecting. I don't do it to make money. I explain to them that I am not going to damage their yard. Like Rob mentioned, I'm going to fill in your hole. And my goal once I'm gone is to leave no trace, that you're not going to be able to tell I was here. I let them know that I take all trash I find with me. I don't leave it in the ground or on top of the ground. And to me, Rob mentioned the etiquette and the code of ethics that a lot of metal detectorists follow. And one of those items is, for me, I always give the property owner first right of refusal to what I find. So that's either, that's a conversation we have at the beginning, if they do allow me permission, is we will talk about, okay, do you want to see everything I find either before I leave today, or I'll go home and clean everything up, send you a photo, and then you tell me you want to keep A, B, and C, or do you not care to keep anything and you just want to see it and I get to take it all home? And in some instances, the property owner will say at the beginning, I just want to keep any toys you find, or I want to keep any jewelry you find. And then I have those expectations of mine managed when I start that permission, that I know, okay, I'm going to have to show the property owner everything, or they only want certain things, or I get to keep it all. So very important to cover all those things at the beginning of the permission.
Yeah, and Rob, you often metal detect on private property. What are your tips to gaining permission from homeowners?
Well, I think the most important thing is to establish some type of trust, you know, and I have a variety of ways I engage or contact with my property owners. But like Jim said, you know, I share with them, I do this for the love of history. I give them the option of keeping, you know, all of their finds, sharing them. That's totally up to them. I do also offer, you know, the opportunity, if they give me permission, to make a small video about the actual event and the items I find, and I tell the story about the historical relevance of the items, that type of thing. What's most important is that you just have a shared understanding of why you're doing this, what will happen with the items to move forward. But the trust is an important one. You know, who are you? You know, are you going to damage my property and that type of thing? And in a very few occasions, I've had the property owner request that I sign a, you know, a liability waiver. You know, oh my gosh, if in the event something were to happen, you know, I, you know, release them. But happily, you know, happy to do that. But I've only had to do that a few times.
As Rob Rizzo, the History Digger, also joining us for the hour, Jim Winter, the Driftless Digger, and you as well at 1-800-642-1234. Stephen in Madison, good morning.
Hi, I was recently in California, and somebody said that they had a gold detector, and I was curious monetarily wise, if people were going to do it for money, how possible it is, and what type of what things do you find that are the most valuable? Is there a gold detector? And what type of detectors are there? I'm curious into the lightest detector that's available, despite the price, that you know of, that is, you know, can pick up these type of things if possible, for a monetary reason. And I'll listen. Thank you.
Yeah, Jim, what types of metal detectors out there? And is there one that can pick up gold for me?
There is a lot of metal detectors. Well, all metal detectors pick up metal, but there are some metal detectors that either have a gold program on them. The Equinox 800 and 900, I have the 800. The MineLab Manticore has a gold program on it. I have that machine as well. Garrett makes some metal detectors that have gold programs, but there are some metal detectors that are specifically made to find gold. Those are a little more expensive. But yeah, you can find gold just like any other metal with a metal detector.
And Rob, can you make money as a digger? Is there money to be made by scouring the land for hidden gold?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a common meme that's often circulated in the metal detecting community. It's a picture of a father handing his young son his first metal detector. And the boy asks his father, he says, "Dad, can you become a millionaire metal detecting?" And the father says, "Yes, you can, son, if you start as a billionaire." And we laugh at that. I mean, there are some people, especially people who metal detect around beaches, who often will find gold rings, and, you know, and I'm sure they convert that into cash. But, you know, most of us do it for other reasons, you know, than that. It's for the enjoyment. And I will just add also to what Jim said, he's absolutely right. There are, you know, almost all of these detectors will, you know, locate and identify gold. However, the more expensive ones are targeted on very small gold nuggets. Oh. And, you know, those can, you know, be, you know, as much as like $10,000, but even for just a few hundred dollars, some of those machines will find gold. And they do. The caller was very astute. They do vary in terms of weight. The lightest metal detector on the market at the moment is produced by a company out of France, and it is called the XP Deus 2. Very light, easy to swing, very comfortable.
Rob Rizzo joining us along with Jim Winter, two diggers who are detectorists, and we're taking a look at the community that metal detecting has built around our state. 800-642-1234 for your stories. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. This is The Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And way back in 1881, Alexander Graham Bell used one of his own inventions to try to save the life of President James Garfield. Garfield had been shot in the back, and Bell was trying to locate the bullet in the president's body using a metal detector. Sadly, the metal springs in President Garfield's bed made Bell's new invention useless, and Garfield would eventually die from a related infection. Now, according to metaldetector.com, this is the first known use of a metal detector in history. Detectorists have come a long way since Alexander Graham Bell. And our guest this hour, Rob Rizzo, is the history digger who travels Wisconsin with his metal detector, finding homeowners who want their old property searched for historical objects or lost items. And Jim Winter, who's known as the driftless digger and has been metal detecting as a hobby since 2019. We invite you to our conversation this hour about the community that the seemingly solitary act of metal detecting can create at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones now where Tom in Madison is standing by. Tom, good morning.
Good morning. I was just wondering if they search for Native American things like arrowheads and other items like that, or items like, I don't know if they can pick up bones, though, like a burials or anything like that with a detector. And then is there anything that they have to report if they found some artifacts like that to the tribes or who owns that? If Tom, you find stuff like that.
Yeah, that's a great question, Tom, and I'm glad you asked it. And I'd be interested in the answer from both of our guests. Jim Winter, the driftless digger, I'll start with you. Any Native American artifacts? And if so, what do you do once they are found?
I have never had the pleasure of going to, hunting for Native American artifacts. If they're made out of metal, you can pick them up, but arrowheads and flints, you cannot. But I do bottle digging as well. That's something, another part of the hobby that I enjoy. And again, that's not something that metal detectors will pick up, but you locate old dumps, do the research, and dig for bottles that way. And as far as when you find something archaeologically significant, each municipality has laws regarding metal detecting, and those are usually outlined in those laws. If you find something architecturally significant or archaeologically significant, you need to report it. But it varies depending on the municipality.
Yeah, and Rob, what about for you? Have you uncovered any Native American artifacts?
Yes, I have actually. So what's interesting about Tom's question, you know, especially where we live, upper Michigan, some portions of Wisconsin, there's a lot of what's called float copper. And the indigenous tribes, of course, realized that, you know, at some point that they could, you know, heat these elements and forge them into useful tools and even weapons. And I had an opportunity last fall. I was detecting with a good friend who came across a copper spear point that was dated all the way back. In fact, the Milwaukee Public Museum helped him date it to what's called the Archaic period. And Lee, if you could believe this or not, this thing was over 8,000 years old.
Ooh.
So you'll find things like that. You will find awls. And sometimes the way they're able to date these is they actually hold the remnants of old pieces of wood that, you know, they can carbon date that. But I happened to be in North Carolina one time, not Wisconsin. It was metal detecting. And metal detectors will not pick up bone. But, and, you know, any type of metal, ferrous or non-ferrous, you'll find. But I did come across a quartz arrowhead that was just in a cotton field. And the farmer had recently come through with his plow and brought it up to the ground. And, you know, and in that particular location, it was private property. We were actually allowed to, you know, pick up and keep that. But it absolutely is key that, and this kind of goes back to those code of ethics, the laws vary greatly. You know, for example, in Wisconsin, there's no metal detecting whatsoever in state parks. Okay. In Michigan, however, you know, certain state parks and beaches, it's permissible. So, but primarily these will find metal, but because you're out there searching, you may come across glass bottles, or you may come across, you know, other items such as, you know, yeah, we would call, often they're called Indian arrowheads, but the truth is more often they were actually the tips of spears, not what we would know as, you know, an arrow with a traditional bow and arrow.
And Rob, you've also gone to the UK to metal detect. What's different in that experience when you take your hobby overseas?
Well, the land there is much older and has, you know, has had generations upon generations, you know, dating back to the, you know, Celtic tribes, for example, or Romans that might have, you know, invaded and occupied parts of the United Kingdom, and then later the Saxons and so on. So just number one, the type of items that you find and the age range, the depth, absolutely fascinating. I was blessed on my very first trip over there to find what's called a hammered gold coin. And it was from the year either 1604 or 5. They don't, you know, at that time they didn't put the dates on the coins, but they knew when it was minted. And on the front of the coin was a profile of King James I, who, interestingly, commissioned the writing of the King James Bible. And also Jamestown was named after King James. But, oh my goodness, it's just incredible. If for any of our listeners who are interested, I'll tell you, there's a British TV show that's wonderful to watch. It introduces them to the hobby, but it's called
The
Detectorists.
Starring Toby Jones. I am familiar.
It's a wonderful show.
It really is a sweet show. And it really made me wonder about the community of detectorists. And we've got that community here in our backyard with our guest this hour. Rob Rizzo is the history digger who you heard there. And also Jim Winter joining us, the driftless digger. And we hope you'll join us as well. At 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or emails available, ideas@wpr.org. I've got a question from Elma here, Rob. And Elma says, actually, Jim, I'll ask this of you. Elma says there were recently in a local conservation park where someone was using a metal detector and they found it disturbing. Have you heard this from others, Jim?
That metal detecting, they get upset by it?
Disturbed by it, or, you know, it's a conservation area and somebody is there overturning the land or at least digging into it.
Sure. Well, yeah, there have been times where I've been out metal detecting and I've had people get upset or ask me what I'm doing. And that's part of the whole going back to making sure you have permission to be there. I let them know right away, I'm here. I have permission to be here. I'm not going to damage the ground. I'm going to leave it as is. So I appreciate people are concerned and care about the land and can sometimes ask questions or raise concerns, but I'm very quick to let them know I'm here with permission. I'm doing this to save history, and I'm not coming in here to take everything out of the ground and steal it or sell it or things like that. And that kind of goes back to the term, I used to use the term treasure hunter, and that was something common in the hobby is, what do you do? Oh, I'm a treasure hunter. I don't like that term anymore. I call myself a history saver because to me, a treasure hunter implies that I'm going somewhere, I'm going to dig everything out of the ground and take it with me. And I just didn't like the way that felt or landed. So I use the term history saver now, and that usually resonates a little better with people when you tell them what you're doing.
Are there rules of etiquette among metal detectors, detectorists? And I think there's actually an episode of the Detectorists from the BBC that's all about this. What are the rules, Jim, of etiquette among other metal detectorists?
Well, if you're going out with other people, if somebody invites you to their permission, you always respect what they are following and what their relationship is with the property owner. Whether that's what you keep and don't keep, revealing the location, you never reveal the location of where you're going if another detectorist is inviting you there, or in a very limited way, you make sure that the detectorist who has that permission is okay with what you're going to share. You always follow their rules and what they're doing there, and you'll be fine.
Let's go back to your questions and comments now. Your story is about metal detecting at 800-642-1234, where Richard in Bayview is standing by. Richard, good morning.
Good morning. I'm wondering what legal basis a municipality would have for if you find something on your property.
So if you find something on your property with a metal detector, why would a municipality have any right to it? Is that... I think that's a fair question, Richard. And Jim, what about your are there rules about who gets what when you dig it up? And are those rules based by a municipality in Wisconsin?
If you're on private property, someone's home, which Rob and I both do a lot, that is that person's private property. Whatever is found on that person's private property is either belongs to that person who owns that property, or if they don't want it, you can take it with you. Public property, a little different, and that kind of goes into municipalities have different rules for metal detecting on public property. And a perfect example is Platteville, Wisconsin, where I lived, and I recently moved to Beloit, Wisconsin. Those municipalities allow metal detecting on any public parks without any issue. You don't need a permit. I lived in Dubuque, Iowa for a while, and that municipality, you had to have a permit every month, and you could only apply to metal detecting two parks a month, and you had to carry that permit with you. And then my hometown of Decatur, Illinois, has outlawed metal detecting in all public parks, period. So the laws regarding detecting really vary by municipality. So it's very important for somebody who's getting into the hobby to make sure they check with where they live to what their metal detecting rules are.
Jim Winter, the Driftless Digger, joining us, as well as Rob Rizzo, the History Digger, and hopefully you before we're done at 1-800-642-1234. The sense of history we find just beneath our feet when we start digging, the sense of community that comes from trying to figure out what it is you just found beneath your feet, and the growing community of metal detectorists across Wisconsin and the clubs and communities that are growing out of it. We invite you to the conversation, 800-642-1234. Also have an email here from ideas@WPR.org, which is available to you anytime. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Morning Show. I'm Lee Rayburn, and who knows what lies just beneath our feet? Detectorists do, but they're not just unearthing bits of old and lost metal, they're uncovering pieces of our history, both shared and sometimes very personal. We have the History Digger Rob Rizzo and the Driftless Digger Jim Winter joining us, and we invite you to the conversation at 1-800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. And Rob, I've got an email here from Robert who simply asks, what's your ratio of trash to treasure?
Oh, what a great question. And it's so important not to give the wrong impression because, I've never mathematically calculated it, but we pull up so many trash items. These could be pull tabs, bottle caps, tin foil, left on the ground, sadly. And in a bit of irony, as Jim mentioned, some of the more advanced metal detectors, they emit a different sound if you're passing your coil over top of iron versus, let's say, silver or gold. But the sound for gold and the number on the machine is absolutely, in many cases, the exact same sound as the pull tab, sadly. So if you want to find, a gold ring or a gold coin, you are going to dig up quite a few pull tabs. I was blessed. I have a good friend, Bruce Rutkowski. He's known as the Bruce in the metal detecting community. He invited me onto a permission in mid-December before the ground froze in Wisconsin. And he was called by a woman who her sister had attended a family event that summer, and sadly, she lost a gold ring that her father had given to her, and it was a memento at this point. And thankfully, it was a private yard versus a park, so there wasn't as much trash. I was using a different metal detector at the time called the MineLab Manticore. And as luck, maybe a little bit of skill would have it, I found it within 20 minutes. We reunited the ring with, you know, its owner, who lived in California, by the way. And she wanted to pay us, which we, of course, declined and refused. But she ended up making a donation to the Tunnel to Towers project. It's a charity I support through my YouTube channel. And I'll just end this little story by saying, you know, sometimes it's about the find or the history, the story. In that case, we were able to, you know, make someone very happy and reunite them with something that they thought they had lost forever.
And there's a similar story that you have out of Chilton where you found a class ring, but not just the class ring. You found the family behind this class ring, Rob.
Well, oh, yes. And this one is a story still in progress. So
really?
This was, yes, this is an older property that I'll just say had, I want to kind of keep the location somewhat private on behalf of the property owner, but let me just say had been metal detected previously. And despite that, found this ring. It was pretty evident it was a ring right away. It was probably about 4 or 5 inches down. I cleaned it off and it was a beautiful clasped ring, kind of an Art Deco style. And you could make out the year 1946. And thankfully, there were three initials inscribed, you know, inside the wedding band. And Chilton back then, the high school wasn't that large. Mm-hmm. Went online, did some research. Many of us also do genealogy research and so on. Found the digitized yearbook and quickly identified who this ring belonged to. Now, sadly, that woman has passed. However, the property owner and I have identified five of her children. And in a few weeks, we will be contacting them. We're not going to tell them exactly what we found, but we're going to surprise them with what it is. But and it's going to be a joy to, you know, return them with something that belonged to their mother or their grandmother.
That is so much more than just a ring, Rob.
Yeah, indeed. And it, that's the part, again, there's so much more than just metal detecting. And I just want to give a nod to Jim, too, because one of the things that Jim does, I think, is so nice. He does so much more of this than I do. But he is quite an active speaker and educator, and he's connecting so many people with this hobby and all these the stories behind these items. And that's part of that community, Lee, that you were mentioning and talking about earlier.
Jim, so you get this question all the time, I imagine. What is your favorite find?
Well, my favorite find came last year, and it was very similar to the story Rob just shared. I was metal detecting an old church in Arthur, Wisconsin, which is just a little hamlet north of Platteville. And about 3 inches underneath a tree root, I found a 10-karat gold class ring. Huh. And it was from Platteville High School, class of 1973. Similar to Rob's ring that he found, it had initials MEV on the inside of that ring. And I knew immediately that my mission was to try and return that ring to the man who had lost it. So I went to the Platteville Public Library, looked up the yearbook, and there was only one young man from the class of 1973 that had the initials MV. His name was Michael Vaca. And so upon doing some internet research, I discovered that Michael actually died in a car accident in 2006. So unfortunately, I wasn't going to be able to get the ring back to him. But I contacted the city editor of the Wisconsin State Journal and asked to see the entire obit. And it listed his family, his widow, and his children in that obituary. So I actually reached out to the widow via Facebook Messenger and to the son, same way, and just said, hey, I think I may have found something that belonged to your late husband and your dad. Would like to talk to you about it. And didn't hear back, which is not uncommon on Facebook Messenger. And so the widow lived at the same house that she lived in back then. So actually one day I just took it upon myself to show up at her front door. Introduced myself, let them know who I was. And I said, I think I have something that belonged to your late husband, and showed her the ring. And I was able to return it to the family. But the story doesn't stop there. The grandson of Michael Vaca and Denise Vaca had an interest in metal detecting. So we went out to the widow's house, and I went around metal detecting with him for a little bit. He got to use my metal detector, gave him some tips and tricks. And this past Christmas, they actually purchased a metal detector from me. And now Michael Vaca's grandson is into metal detecting and is loving it. And hopefully someday he will help somebody recover a class, you know, find a class ring or something else and return it to a family. So that hobby is living on in that way.
That's wonderful, but it does make me start wondering about what's happening with all these class rings. Where are they going? 800-642-1234. With the time we have left, we go to Tom in Madison. Tom, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Interesting show. Thanks, gentlemen. I'm in the blizzard up here in Alaska right now. Anyway, my brother was really into it. My oldest brother, Art, he was a fire officer in Madison before he retired. And he and several others, if I remember the story correctly, paid a really kind of a what seems like a heavy sum. They ponied up $40,000, 10 grand each, to pick some land that was about 2 miles away from Gettysburg that had never been detected.
Oh.
And I wonder if that's common in historical important areas for neighboring properties to kind of lease out or sell out their rights. Or, but I can recall that he came back with buckets full of stuff. I mean, buckets full of stuff. And I didn't see it all. I saw some of it. And I know that some of the pieces that I saw really pulled at you. I mean, this was a super historic and bloody battle in our nation's history. And I'm not sure that personal choice, I would have picked up everything that he got, but sure, my motivations would have been different. I mean, I don't know. I'm not into the sport, not into the hobby. So
sure, but
there were things that kind of brought a little, you know, choke in your throat.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure I would have brought some of those things.
Interesting,
you know?
But it put you there. It took you there. I mean, that was the power of those finds. We are just about out of time, but if you had a bucket list that for a place that you'd like to go metal detect, Rob, where would it be?
Well, that's a great question. So actually this May, I am metal detecting a property adjacent to the Manassas battlefield in Virginia. And so I am looking forward to that. And it's, you know, battlefields, national battlefields. So that is very much hallowed ground.
Yeah.
And, you know, many of us do this so that we, you know, we remember history, we can preserve it. And these items will tell the stories, you know, to future generations. But there is so much history all around us. And it's just, and this hobby is wonderful because it helps introduce us to not only artifacts, the story about why and how they got there. I have a bucket list, Lee, that we would have to save for another show.
We will, because we're out of time, Rob. Yes. I want to thank you both for joining us this morning. Rob Rizzo is the history digger who you heard there. Travels the state with his metal detector, finding homeowners who want their older properties searched for historical objects or lost items. And Jim Winter, known as the drift list digger, who's been metal detecting as a hobby since 2019. We appreciate all your calls and comments as well this morning. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.